From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is May 16th. On today's show, Edible Hudson Valley has dropped their latest spring issue. From Mexican to Korean cuisines, we chat with Editor-in-Chief's Todd Spire about what to expect this spring. A nature-based retreat in Hankins, New York is bringing food advocates, environmentalists, and community leaders together to unwind and collaborate this June.
This is a space in nature to actually be connecting with other people and with the natural environment.
Plus, a microfarm in Mountaindale shares the power of regenerative agriculture. And a conversation with the acting executive director of New York State's Office of Cannabis Management. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Voters in Louisiana are heading to the polls today for a Senate primary election that will test President Trump's grip on the Republican Party. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy is facing two primary challengers after he voted to convict Trump on impeachment charges after the January 6th insurrection. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports.
Most of the seven Republican senators who voted to remove Trump in 2021 have retired. Cassidy is seeking a third term, despite Trump recruiting Congresswoman Julia Letlow to challenge him. Voters like Kevin Dupree say Cassidy's vote felt like a betrayal.
I'm the type of person, if you cross me, I probably won't trust you anymore. So I think his political career in Louisiana is finished.
St. Martin Parish GOP Chair Kelby Daigle says that's troubling.
Conservatism is about ideas and principles, and they always make it about Trump. What are you going to do when he's no longer in the picture?
Cassidy wants to repair his relationship with Trump supporters and tout his independence. This race will test whether that's possible. Sam Greenglass, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street bounced up and down this week before ending about where they started. NPR's Scott Horsley reports rising inflation spooked investors in the bond market.
Both the S&P 500 index and the NASDAQ were in record territory on Thursday, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average topped 50,000 for the first time since the U.S. went to war with Iran. That war has caused a spike in energy prices and pushed the annual inflation rate to its highest level in almost 3 years. Retail sales continued to climb last month, but that was largely due to those higher prices. The more money people had to spend at the gas station, the less willing they were to spend on furniture, clothing, and cars. Bond prices slumped on Friday, and stocks gave up some of their earlier gains. For the week, the S&P gained 0.1%. The NASDAQ slipped about 0.1%, and the Dow fell close to 0.2. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Israel says it has killed the man in charge of Hamas's armed wing hitting a residential building in Qar in Gaza City. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports local hospitals say at least seven people were killed.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says he instructed the military to carry out the strike on Izzeddin al-Haddad, who leads Hamas's armed wing, the Qassam Brigades. The statement described al-Haddad as one of the architects of the deadly October 7th attack on Israel in 2023, saying he also oversaw the captivity of hostages. Al-Haddad was among the armed group's founding members more than 30 years ago and took over after its previous leader and his deputy were assassinated by Israel during the war in Gaza. Unlike those attacks, this took place during a ceasefire that was agreed upon 7 months ago. That ceasefire remains fragile. Hamas says it will not discuss disarming until Israel fulfills the first phase of the deal, including halting its lethal attacks. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County posted the steepest first quarter sales tax decline in New York State, 16% down from this time last year in sales tax revenue. County Director of Communications Dan Hoost said the figure may even be closer to 20% since the first official figures were released.
I'd say serious. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Obviously, we hope it turns around.
The decline stands in contrast to statewide and regional trends. Neighboring counties showed a 5.2% increase in sales tax collections during the same period. County Manager Joshua Potosik has warned the county could fall as much as $14.5 million short of projections if the trend continues. Hoost said officials are not downplaying that risk.
It is looking grim, but not hopeless. It is looking like We may have to make some harder decisions later this year, but we're doing everything we can to avoid that because we don't want to remove services that could hurt the very people that we serve.
County officials are warning that continued revenue declines could eventually affect services despite efforts to control costs. Who said departments have already been instructed to reduce spending wherever possible?
The word has gone out to all our commissioners and department heads. No excess spending. We're limiting overtime. We're not filling vacant positions that may not be absolutely crucial and necessary at that time. So we're trying to tighten our belt as much as possible. It's all hands on deck to try to avoid any kind of significant property tax increase for 2027.
This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, Edible Hudson Valley recently dropped its latest spring issue, and it takes a global approach to our local region. From Mexican to Lebanese to Korean cuisines, the stories take readers around the world. Joining me on the phone now is Todd Spire, Edible Hudson Valley's editor-in-chief. Edible Hudson Valley explores the region through the stories of food, drink, and the people behind it. Todd, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, I'm really excited because the last time we spoke, you know, you were getting ready to drop the spring 2026 issue. It's finally here. It just recently dropped. First off, you know, just congratulations on such a beautiful edition. I'd love to just hear a little bit more about some of the stories in it.
Thank you for the kudos. It was a beautiful issue coming together again with so much local talent. Also, which is a true pleasure. We have a new designer on staff who used to be one of the designers with a local magazine called Deviate, which was really well liked in the area. And an old friend of mine, Stephen Mayle, and he's on board with us now. And the issue did really come out beautiful. So thanks for mentioning it. I think it came up in the last show that we had this travel theme for the issue, which we thought would be about traveling to the area and became a global trot, so to speak. Mm. And we did incorporate cuisines from all over the world. We have some cutting edge stuff coming out of New York City with an article about a place called Sandwich. And it's actually sort of this Filipino sandwich culture that the chef has created. And apparently, sandwiches barely even exist in Filipino culture. So here's somebody that's kind of like taking our common modern sensibilities of to-go and infusing his own cultural tastes into some of brand new food and sandwich creations that no one's ever really had before. So there are interesting stories like that. And then there are ones that hit really local, like one about Together Farms, which is really actually pretty close to where you guys are. And it's run by a gentleman named Eugene Kwok. And Eugene is actually an architect who decided, in a way, on a whim, to throw his energy into farming. Mm. And he started this farm a few years ago. And the farm basically holds two functions. One is that it has a partnership with Hand Hospitality down in New York City, which operates 20 Korean restaurants across the boroughs, more than one of which are Michelin stars. So some of them are really high end. And the chefs participate in coming up and running this farm and developing produce specifically for the restaurants. There's this great quote that from the article that
ingredients set the ceiling. It doesn't matter how skillful you are as a chef, but ultimately the quality of the food is limited by the quality of the ingredients. And so you have this cadre of chefs that come up and farm, are learning about the produce, and then developing produce specifically for the farms, for the restaurants, down in the city. The other half of the Together Farms program is basically an incubator for small regenerative farmers. And they've started a program there with a young couple, but they've developed a very successful local farm and will eventually grow that farm off the property, and a new entity will come in and take over this sort of farm incubator space that they have.
Yeah, Together Farms, as you mentioned, is just in our neck of the woods in Bloomingburg. So I was so excited to see them in this issue, and with gorgeous photos of the farm. I mean, beautiful, beautiful imagery that was incorporated in this latest issue.
Yeah, of course. In that case, since Eugene is an architect, both the house that sits on the property and everything around it is quite beautiful. You're absolutely right.
You know, Todd, I don't know if I ever mentioned, but so my family's from the Philippines and I'm Filipino. And when I saw the story of Eric and just some of the ways that he's kind of bringing this contemporary take to traditional Filipino food, I mean, definitely hit home in a really heartwarming and nostalgic way.
Oh, that's really wonderful. That's fantastic. Thanks for sharing.
And, you know, I'm kind of combing through some of the pages of the issue, and I see this really interesting story about a tiny pizza kitchen in a bowling alley. And I'm curious if you could talk to me a little bit about this story.
Yeah, and this story, I happened to write this story, and it's a quick little piece. And sometimes, you know, it's harder to encapsulate things in a fewer number of words. As a writer, any writer will tell you that. But also, because this story is literally just down the road from me, it really kind of hits home in this beautiful way. Augie Rousseau started a curbside pizza pop-up, having never cooked pizza before during the pandemic. He cooked for many, many years as a wedding venue chef, and every iteration between that and high food. And during the pandemic, he just decided he wanted to make pizza, and he wound up getting reviewed by the New York Times, and his business exploded. And long story short, he recently relocated the business to the Catskills, right up near one of the most popular trailheads up in Slide Mountain. He's sort of like a different version of taking traditional Neapolitan pizza and putting a modern spin on it. And his enthusiasm as a chef is so infectious. His intimacy with his ingredients, his excitement about his intimacy with local ingredients, which I'm sort of immediately thinking about our first conversation and that spoiled nature that we all have of living up here, where even somebody who's as deeply enmeshed in food making as someone like Augie, to be suddenly enraptured by the fact that he's close to his ingredients is really remarkable. Yeah, it's sort of a do not miss kind of place. The pizza is utterly incredible. It's located in this historic, authentic roadside motel. All of the decorations have been that way for like 100 years. It wasn't somebody that curated everything out of the best spots to make this authentic Catskills joint. It literally is as it has been forever. And it includes this two-lane manual bowling alley that you can just get in line and play. It's really just a fantastic Catskills experience.
You know, Todd, I have really been enjoying our conversations because I love talking to other writers and journalists in the region. Because I think for you, especially, like hearing you talk about Augie, you talk about it with such passion. And like, I feel like I know Augie in a sense. I don't know if that's strange to say, but like, I feel like I know Augie's story, even from you just talking about him and his operation. And I'm curious, when you're kind of approaching this interview and this conversation with a restaurateur or a chef or a farmer. What is that process like for you? What is the first thing that comes to mind or maybe that you ask them?
You never know where someone's going to be coming from as a chef or as a maker or as a farmer. We all tick in these different sorts of ways. So anybody who's a writer or is interested in other people's stories always tries to approach them objectively, right? And back to this notion that we live in such an incredible, rich, developed food system, the thing that I continually become amazed by is just how high the bar is being set by our makers right now across the region. You have restaurants that are, despite every obstacle, still operating on a 100% locally sourced version of making food. It's next to impossible to do that through the winter season, even with the fertile environment that we have here. And for somebody like Augie, he's influenced by a lifetime of experience, and it all goes into their food, into his food, and into the foods that so many chefs in the area make. And that just comes right up to the surface whenever you speak with people who are this impassioned and setting a bar for themselves that is so high. Something beautiful always comes out. You just have to listen.
That's beautiful. I think that's such great advice. I want to lift up one story that I know that Edible Hudson Valley has been following it, and we were reporting on as well, was the frost that hit the region that affected apple farms. And I'm curious if you could tell me a little bit about some of the folks that you spoke to.
Yeah, we spoke to quite a few orchards across the region. And I should just lead with, there's a beautifully written article by Stephen Casals, who's a well-known wine expert and grape expert in the Hudson Valley. And you can check that out on our website, ediblehudsonvalley.com, to get a lot of details and reporting basically from the field from about a half dozen different farms. But the problem here is actually twofold, and it gets a little bit tricky, because on one hand, the frost, even though in this case it was deep, it was very cold that night, but the frost itself isn't all that irregular. The fact that we had immensely warm days preceding that frost that forced several, you know, trees to bloom,
right,
and vines to bloom early, so that then the frost results in bud loss. And so it's a dual problem in a way, but it's actually mostly that early season heat, and that's something that we see across the board. You know, talk about ecologies that are local to our area. In the fly fishing world, we have very specific calendars knowing when different insects are going to hatch on the river. That calendar is exactly the same as it's always been. It just has slid up about a week to 2 weeks from season to season, from what we used to expect year after year. So it's this shifting of the warm part of the season that's affecting our ecologies and affecting things from agriculture to fishing. But we spoke with a horticulturist at the Cornell Cooperative Extension who estimated that across the entire Hudson Valley, 90% bud loss for anything that had bloomed across the board. So in a way, the northern reaches in the Catskills were impacted slightly less than the downstate regions like Putnam and Dutchess counties, who were hit unbelievably hard. So it's a time to really encourage everybody to still go out and try and spend time at those local farms. A lot of the UPIC crops were hit hardest because a lot of those apples tend to bloom early. In the world of cider making, we have a little bit of hope in that many of the apples that bloom for cider making tend to bloom a little bit later. So there's some salvation there.
That's something that we were hearing as well. I mean, when we were working on this story, apples for the state. New York is the second largest apple producing state in the country. I'm thinking of one winemaker we spoke to. It's like, it's the apples plus the plums and the cherries. I think that's something that we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on. And I'm sure that you guys will as well.
So that we'll be watching as we move into the harvesting season in the fall too, and actually see where everybody winds up.
Well, you know, before we sign off, I know that the issue dropped in recent weeks, but how can folks find it?
Well, as I said earlier, you can head to ediblehudsonvalley.com. The entire digital edition is there, both as a flipbook, or you can read story by story, and also get into stories from our other regions downstate, like Brooklyn and Manhattan as well, if you're interested.
We have been chatting with Todd Speyer, Edible Hudson Valley's editor-in-chief, about the latest spring issue and other stories that Edible Hudson Valley is watching. Todd, thank you again so much for chatting.
Thank you.
A microfarm in Mountaindale that operates entirely on harvesting rainwater. That's just part of the story behind Painter's Hill Farm. Manon Frappier and Ian Miner are the co-owners and farmers at Painter's Hill Farm. It's a small farm that is on about, 60-something acres of forested land in the Catskills. And I visited them a few weeks ago and just had a really great time. I can't remember what day of the week it was, but it was a weekday morning, and the two of them have just such an infectious energy about them, around their farm, and are just really passionate about growing food for their community. But they're also really passionate about, operating small scale. So here is some of that conversation with Manon and Ian about their farm, Painter's Hill Farm.
We're here in Mountaindale, New York, Sullivan County, the wrong side of the valley, if you will, the wrong side of the Hudson, the wrong side of everything, and it feels so right. With no electricity, no anything, on top of a little mountaintop.
You can't see where we are, but we're surrounded by beautiful trees, nature as far as the eye can see. You don't hear anything except maybe birds. And we irrigate our farm with rainwater. So there's no utilities at the moment. So we, Ian is brilliant with coming up with schemes and plans to make this work. So we have this pool. It's an old camp or some kind of, weekend place. And so there's this big abandoned pool that is our water collector. And Ian figured out a way to pump it out, get it up in these tote tower, 250-gallon totes, and with gravity, he engineered this irrigation for the farm, which is absolutely amazing, because on my own, there's no way. I'm the micro thinker, so the seeds, the variety, the soil, all that, and Ian's infrastructure, big ideas.
And to add to that, she's so right. We work so well together. She came from fashion, worked at Calvin Klein, vice president of accessories, had a huge team, glamorous life. I'm from construction business, and where I hear this is, we the journey started with going to the farmer's market, Grand Army Plaza Farmer's Market, right outside of our doorstep, eating that food, planted a seed, so to speak, that we didn't realize at the time, and here we are, I know using our same research and analytical skills to find the right varieties, to find the seeds, the equipment we needed to plant the seeds. Meanwhile, I'm looking at where the snow melts first, the lay of the land to be what we want to be, which is organic is just a term. We're beyond that. Biodynamic is a term. That's what they call it in France. which is pretty legit right now, but that could be corporatized very just as easily. We just say we're naturally grown. Soil health is what we're shooting for.
It's key,
how many worms do we have per foot? Per square foot, we're looking for 25 worms. That says our soil is healthy. We've increased it.
You consider yourself a micro farm. Tell me about what that means to you and why it's important for the way that you want to run and operate your farm and also live the life that you want.
You know, the industrialization of America in a way. And we grew up in the 70s and Campbell's soup and Cheez-Its and all these, you know, at the time it was cool. It was an invention and it was like, you know, what that time was all about. Polyester, God forbid, all these great or not so great invention, but that's that period. And now we really see a change. We have two sons, Philippe and Alexander. They're 28 and 25. And we also see in them, in their generation, like they want to get closer to nature. A lot of the kids of their generation, where does food come from? The supermarket. And of course, that's not true. Food doesn't come from the food supermarket. It's a channel where you can buy it. But we've very much been working on this marketing concept of who's your farmer? Like, we know our dog walker, you know, your barber, or your hairdresser, or your kid's teacher. But do you know your farmer? Who feeds you and how do they feed you? What does their farm look like? What does their soil look like? We really don't know when you go to the supermarket, like, what are the conditions around where this food is coming from? Now we're starting to see free range and, you know, grass fed this, but there's so much we don't know. And also a big thing for us is harvested by date. You know, you see food, when will it spoil? I don't want to know when it's spoiled. I want to know when it came out of the ground. And you can't beat it with micro farms. You know, when you go to your farmer's market or you get a CSA from them, you know that it came out of the ground the day before, or maybe, God forbid, 2 days before. You know, it's super fresh. And you want to feed yourself and your family and your community healthy food, not that whole processed or pesticide-controlled product.
I want to ask you a little bit about the beginnings of farming for you. What did that look like? Yeah. And how has your relationship to the land changed since then?
Yeah, so that's interesting. Obviously, Ian being in design build and me in the fashion industry, which is the second most polluting industry. And I knew all along, of course, that my work was polluting. But I loved the creative part so much. I loved my team. I loved what I did. So I turned a blind eye to it. And it got to a point where I couldn't do it anymore. And farming wasn't our first idea. We knew coming in this land that we wanted to keep it as untouched as possible. We love nature as it is. But I think it really, when we were in France, we really, you know, you're in Paris, a huge metropolitan, a huge city, and you drive half an hour out and you're the country, and everywhere it's agriculture. It's amazing. So coming here, that was kind of an inspiration. We're like, okay, we have this great land. Let's farm it for ourselves at first. And then we realize we love doing this. We love doing this. So I took classes. Ian read a lot. We met farmers. We're part of Sullivan CCE and that group that we adore. They have such great resources. They matched us up with mentors. I mean, it's just falling in love with having our hands in the soil and being outside. It's just so, you feel so alive. It's just a beautiful thing.
I'm going to say another side of it. If we knew what the hell we were getting into, would we have done it?
No.
There was nothing here, all right? Like, look, I feel comfortable out here now, but I thought Prospect Park was like nature. You know, I thought that when we came out here, I'm like, Who cuts the lawn here? Like what the hell is this? You know, like, you can't walk through, there's brush everywhere. I say it took a second to slow down and see nature. So starting it out, I mean, we laugh about this and we have pictures and we're like, what the hell were we thinking? Like, you know, Cornell Cooperative Extension that my wife was telling me about, I called Michelle Procher from there on the way from Canada when we were living in Montreal, trying to move down here, trying to establish ourselves back up. And I was like, I think I want to do a farm. Can you help? Blah, blah, blah. She came here and looked at this.
And it looked like this.
Yep. Boring. And she's like, yeah, I guess, yeah, that would work. You know, I said, bless you know, her. I see the snow melts here. We're facing south. And to make a long story short, yeah. Here we are, you know, I think you have to have some insanity and a lot of things. You just, you start out and...
Insanity or heart. It was just, it's a passion project.
Yes, yes,
we came
yes,
here and yes. we're like, yeah. let's do it, you know? And again, if we knew the hours and the muscle effort and
ignorance
the sore backs.
Is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss. And it's a day by day. We just dive in there and we love it. We just love being outside and it makes us so happy when it's farmers market time of the year and we come face to face with our customers and they're so happy and we're so happy. It's just like, to me, that's success. It's not having a big mansion and a yacht or whatever it is that success may represent financially. We've redefined success not to how much money's in our bank account, but to how much love and community connection we've developed over the years. It's priceless.
Well, before we sign off, do you want to let folks know how they can find you this season?
Absolutely. We're going to be at the Rock Hill Farmers Market starting, is it Saturday, June 6th, till the end of September, every Saturday, 10 to 1. Our produce are also for sale at Forage and Gather in Hurleyville. And we...
CSA on the website.
CSA, exactly. We can also, you can also visit us at Painters Hill Farm. Painters.com. Painters, several painters, one hill, paintershillfarm.com, and on Instagram, also at Painters Hill Farm. So come, tag us, join us, request a basket filled with fresh goodness, and or at the farm.
Thanks again to Painters Hill Farm for the conversation. We'll take a short break, but coming up, the latest Star Talk. Stay with us.
Hudson Valley Gives is Wednesday, May 20th. 24 hours to support Radio Catskill and all the great participating nonprofit organizations in our community. May 20th, visit hvgives.org and make a donation to Radio Catskill. All giving ends at 11:59 p.m., so make sure to make your gift on time. You don't need to be from the Hudson Valley to participate, and any amount of support is appreciated. hvgives.org.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Hari Kondabolu was all for putting toys back in kids' cereal boxes, but he wanted more.
I love that they brought the toys back, but I've always felt that adult cereals should have, like, things in them, too.
Yeah.
Like Viagra or Lipitor.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, we turned the tables on Jeopardy host Ken Jennings by asking him questions in the form of a question. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk Report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The two brightest objects in the night sky will be close together Monday evening. Earth's natural satellite and the planet known as Earth's sister planet will be in the western sky at sunset and will remain visible until about 10 p.m. The moon and Venus will be 3 degrees from each other. It will be a worthwhile sight to see the two brightest objects in the sky so close together. The waxing crescent moon will be lit on the right side. Through binoculars or a telescope, the craters that lie along the line separating the lighted side of the moon from the darkened side will stand out in sharp relief. Venus will be unmistakable just to the left of the moon. Like the moon,
Venus goes through phases. Currently, Venus will be in a waning gibbous phase, meaning there will be a thin crescent of shadow on her left side. To see the phases of Venus, a telescope with a magnification of at least 30 is required. With the Moon and Venus being next to each other, the difference in brightness between the two will really stand out. While Venus will be shining at a magnitude -3.9, the Moon will be a very bright -7. The brightness scale is logarithmic rather than linear, which means the Moon will be 17 times as bright as Venus. Look in the western sky in the evening on Monday to see Venus 3 degrees to the left of the Moon. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Well, if you are just joining us, you're listening to Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. John Kaggia is stepping into one of the most closely watched roles in New York government at a critical moment for the state's legal cannabis industry. Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo spoke with the recently appointed acting executive director of the New York Office of Cannabis Management about the business behind the industry and what's in store for business owners. Here is some of that conversation.
John Kaggia is stepping into one of the most closely watched roles in New York government. Governor Kathy Hochul recently appointed him as acting executive director of the New York Office of Cannabis Management, HC that's faced significant challenges during the rollout of legal cannabis. He previously served as the agency's policy director, helping shape regulations for medical, adult use, and hemp markets. Now he takes over at a pivotal moment following a leadership shakeups and ongoing concerns about licensing delays, illegal shops, and whether the state's equity-focused vision is working as intended. So welcome to the program, John. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here, Patricia. Thank you for having me.
So yeah, like I stated before, you know, in the intro that, you know, you're stepping into this role at a very critical moment here. How would you describe the current state of New York's cannabis industry right now?
Well, I think we're in a really exciting moment for legal cannabis in New York. We've grown tremendously as an industry over the last 3 years since we opened the first adult use licensed dispensary in New York State. And the numbers, really tell a compelling story about both how much work has been done to build this market and how much the industry has grown as we've made legal cannabis more accessible. So just some numbers to put this industry in context. To date, we've issued over 2,000 licenses across our supply chain, including cultivators, processors, manufacturers, distributors, and retail stores. We have over 600 stores now open, and are well on pace to exceed 700 stores here within the first half of this year. Since sales began in 2023, we've done over $3 billion in sales. And just this year alone, in 2026, we're on pace to do between $2.5 and $3 billion in legal sales. So we certainly acknowledge that there's a lot more to do. There's a lot more folks waiting for applications to be processed to secure their position in this market. There's a lot more kind of parts of the state where we will be issuing licenses and ensuring that consumers can get access. And, you know, there's a lot more to do as we think about the emergence of both a national and a global legal cannabis industry. But, you know, we've done an incredible amount of work to this point, and I look forward in this role to continuing to build on the phenomenal work that the office has done to date.
Now, you know, you said you were previously the policy director for the agency. You know, what made you want to take this job, and especially given the challenges that the agency has faced?
Well, you know, I approach my career in terms of doing challenging things. I love the Kennedy quote of, we don't do these things because we're easy, we do them because they're hard. And candidly, as I reflected on the opportunity, and I'm so grateful to the governor for kind of considering us for this role, there's a few things that made it really kind of appealing and exciting to me. One, I've been with the agency since 2022. And in my time here, I've had the privilege of working with some of the most kind of passionate, committed, dedicated, entrepreneurial people I've ever had the privilege of working with across my career. Two, you know, we are transitioning as an agency out of startup mode where, you know, it's important to recall that 5 years ago, none of this existed. And in the intervening 5 years, we've built an agency of over 270 people who are managing the implementation of one of the most robust and sophisticated regulated cannabis programs in the world. And so, you know, work over the last 3 years has really been about both standing up the agency and laying the foundation for the industry. But now that that core kind of foundation and table setting has been done, there's a huge amount of work still to do to grow this program, to refine our approach, to ensure its long-term sustainability. And I'm really excited about the opportunity to do that. And then third, you know, we are at an inflection point. Just last week, the federal government announced that it was rescheduling medical cannabis and was putting full rescheduling of cannabis on the table for discussion as we go into this year. These are some of the most consequential, not just cannabis policy changes, but drug policy changes in the last century of the United States. And so what a privilege it is to be able to help steward and participate in not only the decisions that are going to consequentially impact New York's market, but given New York's leadership role in the country and truly in the world, helping ensure that the industry we're building reflects the very best of New York, but also, too, that New York can play a leadership role in the emerging global cannabis economy.
Now, you know, having said all that, you know, a lot of accomplishments there of the cannabis management agency there. But, you know, a lot of people have said and has been saying that the rollout has been slower and more complicated than expected. What do you think has been some of the biggest issues your agency has faced?
Well, so first, I'll take a little bit of an exception about, you know, the to the point about the rollout taking longer than expected. Only in that, if you benchmark the pace at which New York went from legalization, so the law passing, to an agency being stood up, to over 600 dispensaries open, over 2,000 licenses issued. Certainly, if you compared our progress against other programs in the country, you'd find that we've actually moved really quickly. We understand that New Yorkers want everything in a New York minute, and so we certainly respect the desire for us to move more quickly. But you know, if you look at the scale and complexity of the program being built, I actually think we have moved quite quickly. Two, certainly now acknowledging that we have a lot of applicants who have been waiting for determination from the office. We're working as hard and as fast as we can to get those license applications reviewed, those licenses issued, so that folks can start their business. But we have a relatively small team. And while we've been very grateful for the support that the governor and her team have shown our office in terms of ensuring that we're able to get both the personnel and the technical infrastructure that we need to accelerate our progress. You know, we recognize that as a brand new agency that has been building both the entire kind of regulatory frame for this market, as well as implementing licensing, compliance, enforcement against the unregulated market, judicial processes, so that everyone who is intercepted by the enforcement unit can get their day in court. All of the public health work that we are doing to ensure that young kids aren't getting exposed to medical to cannabis inappropriately.
Thanks so much to Patricio for that conversation. You can find the whole discussion between Patricio and John up on our website at wjffradio.org. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, a new retreat for community advocates and environmentalists in Hankins. That's up next.
Hi, I'm LJ Rule, Chair of Radio Catskills Community Advisory Board, inviting you to a casual get-together on Thursday, May 21st from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at La Cigone, 90 Main Street in Narrowsburg. It's a chance to stop by, meet CAB members, and talk about our community, what's working, what's needed, and how Radio Catskill can better serve our listeners. Join the conversation. Radio Catskills Community Advisory Board Meetup, Thursday at La Cigone in Narrowsburg. All are welcome.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. A nature-based retreat in Hankins, New York, is bringing food advocates, environmentalists, and community leaders together to connect, unwind, and collaborate. Standing People Together and Damascus Citizens for Sustainability will be hosting Ecotopia in June. And joining me in the studio now is Caroline Bailey, Professor, Theater Director, and Co-Director of Waste for Life. Caroline, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, you along with Standing People Together and Damascus Citizens for Sustainability will be hosting this Ecotopia retreat on June 13 to 14. We're going to get to the partners organizing this in just a moment, but let's start with just the inspiration, you know, behind this retreat and who it's intended for.
Thank you so much. Ecotopia, the name is a really fun one. It comes from the book Ecotopia, and it was written many years ago now, the idea of an environmental utopia. And we took that name when we first came here, actually, about 8 years ago, the idea of, you know, that this really is an environmental utopia, and that there are many organizations working to support local community and environment. And we didn't know who they all were.
Hmm.
And we thought maybe it would be great if they were all connected in some way. Years later, we know mostly who they all are now, but we still feel as if they're not really connected. We spend a lot of our time in our work through Standing People Together, connecting people to people and people to nature. And we would love for people who are working on looking after our environment, looking after our community, to join us at this Ecotopia retreat so we can connect better to one another. If we're actually sitting in nature, surrounded by the trees and the beautiful surroundings that we have here, as those of you who love being in nature know, we calm down. We stop the rush of the day, and we just appreciate the sounds around us, and we can actually stop and listen and pay attention to the people that are with us. And that special time together actually is very, very rare. And so we would really love to be able to invite anybody, anybody who you know, maybe doesn't work for an organization, but would love to somehow do some more to support our beautiful environment, whether you're a weekend visitor or where you live here all the time. And we can create some sort of collective wisdom to enable us to be much stronger than we are as an individual or as an individual organization.
And, you know, as you describe, this is a nature-based retreat. Tell me a little bit more about maybe some of the conversations or sessions that folks can expect during this weekend together.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. When we use the word retreat, often people conjure up what they used to. Maybe they haven't ever been to a retreat and they're a bit scared. Or maybe they have and they're expecting it to be like that. And so often I can describe it by what it won't be. This is not a sort of a transactional retreat where you pay a lot of money and you get pampered or you get given lots of information. This is not a retreat which is mostly about self-improvement. This is a space in nature to actually be connecting with other people and with the natural environment. We use principles from forest school pedagogy. Both Eric, my husband, and I are trained in forest school, which is coming over mostly from Europe, although it was originally from the US maybe 50 years ago, and is now starting to get a little bit more popular here. We train a lot of the public schools in forest school here so that they can take their kids out into nature and not just learn about the frogs and the trees, but also learn about their normal curricula, their maths and their English outside. We take some of the same ideas and activities and kind of do forest school for adults. When they did this in England, a lot of the adults were like, what about me? It looks so much fun. I want to do it too. And you start to see that doctors are prescribing forest school for mental health issues, for dementia, for depression, for learning disabilities, because it has such a beneficial effect. And often when we go out for the day. We might go for a hike. We'll go for a canoe ride. And we're always trying to achieve something. But actually going outside and just being is very different. There's a stillness that happens. And so we adopt some of the techniques and approaches that really kind of come from forest school and adapt them and enable them to be appropriate sort of tools to help conversations emerge. And I can give some examples if you're interested.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Well, so one of our favorites is called the soundscape. And it is so beautifully simple. It's easy to describe. And this works for little children as well as it does adults of any kind. And the person will go and sit in their own spot in the forest, and they will draw what they hear. And that's a stillness. There's nothing else that you do. You just literally listen. The little kids might notice the ants crawling on the ground. You have all sorts of winds and bird songs that you didn't really notice before. And the interpretation of that in drawing it is not, you're not supposed to make it look like a bird. And some people, some engineers do frequency of sound, strangely enough. It's completely up to you. And what's beautiful also is afterwards we then share all of this around, maybe we're sitting around the fire talking, and we find all sorts of insights. And what we do in our forest retreats, and we've been doing these for a number of years, is we have critical conversations, we call it, over a couple of days, where we sort of build on the conversation over the 2 days. So we're not going to say we're going to be talking about this between 10 and 11, but there's some sort of activity that will precipitate a conversation. And then the next activity, we can build on that. One example I can think of is one of the participants one time noticed that when an aeroplane flew overhead, all the birds stopped singing. And just that one moment, we started to talk about the huge impact of the built environment on our natural world and how we just don't realize what it's like to be a bird when the road has been built. Some of those insights really stay with you. And so the activities and the fun kind of activities that we do lead on to these really deeply insightful conversations that we might have sitting by the stream, sitting by the fire, walking through the woods. And by the end of the 2 days, we both know each other better. We care for each other more because we kind of understand each other's values. We're much more likely to work together in the future and support each other's programming. But we may also have built something really special because creativity can emerge.
And I mean, what a gift to be able to do it together, right? Like, that's something that I often hear is that, you know, from folks who are maybe in the same, you know, space, they're just very busy doing the work.
It is a treat. It's a treat for us to run it. I was talking to Eric about it the other day, and I said, you know, creating these spaces, it's like an alternate time and space where you can really stop with the noise, literally the noise that we all suffer with every day, and start to imagine a new way of being. That's a privilege, of course, that affords those of us who can sit around in the forest for 2 days. And, you know, we make this very accessible. It's basically pay what you can. It covers the costs of the food and materials that we use up to a maximum of, you know, $75. So basically, if you can't pay, you don't have to. And so it is very accessible. One of the things we would love is for people who work on all of the kind of issues related to our land, looking after our land, looking after our environment and our community, such as water, food, waste, energy, health, justice, to all come together and talk to one another. They're the very people who are busy, you know, they're right. Planting food. They won't be able to. I do appreciate that. But maybe, just maybe, you can think, actually, I owe it to myself to just have a couple of days off and treat myself. We would really welcome you to join us.
Well, you're doing this in collaboration with partners in the region, Standing People Together and Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. Tell me a little bit about the partners that you're working with.
Well, we are Standing People Together, our organization. That's myself and Eric Feinblatt. And we started Standing People Together Interestingly, standing people is an indigenous word that means trees. And the idea of people standing together with nature and people standing together themselves. We're partnering with Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. You'll see their storefront in Narrowsburg on the main street. And they just advocate for everything to do with sustainability in the local region. If you haven't heard of them or come across them, you haven't been to Narrowsburg yet. But they are looking after things relating to energy and water and food and waste. And just drop by their storefront anytime, usually at the weekends. You'll find Jane Cypher, who's there, and she'll be able to help you. We just decided to focus together on this. They've been here a lot longer than we have and have lots of connections. And we host the retreats.
And, you know, we're going to get to how folks can register, but I'm curious just from your perspective, what do you hope people take away at the end of the weekend?
I hope that people are finding themselves a space of peace that they didn't know was there and a restfulness. It's quite remarkable at the end of these 2 days, and it's hard to describe. And in fact, when I was talking to Eric and a lot of people we were talking to, and one person said, I don't really understand what's going to happen at this retreat. And I said, well, yeah, I can understand that. If you're expecting there to be lessons in, you know, foraging or how to tie knots, it does sound a little strange. We're just going to talk in the trees, guys, really.
Which sounds lovely.
Does sound lovely to some people. Some people are like, what? I don't know. But the joy and the peacefulness that gives you is quite remarkable. There's a sense of awe. There's just a sense of, oh my gosh, this is what living is that happens at the end of those 2 days. So that's one thing, which I cannot describe properly. I just did a very bad job of it. The second is that we will make friends, that we will connect with each other and really support one another. I mean, I personally would love an Ecotopia map, you know, with all of the beautiful things that are happening all connected, and we could just post that on the web somewhere, and then visitors would be, oh, look, we can go and see farm arts over here, and we can go to the forest school over here, and we can go pick our own ramps over here, and that they just see all of those things in one place. How beautiful would that be?
Well, the Ecotopia retreat is coming up in just a few weeks. How can folks register or find more information?
Yes. Yeah, so our overarching organization is called Waste for Life, and you can register at wastefullife.org/events.
Awesome. We have been chatting with Caroline Bailey, professor, theater director, and co-director of Waste for Life. The retreat is happening on June 13 to 14 in Hankins, New York. Caroline, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
A few happenings in our community the next few days. Tomorrow, May 17th, Justin Wexler, a local expert on the Catskills Indigenous history, will be giving a talk on the Esopus Band of the Munsee Lenape tribe. That'll be at 2 p.m. at the Middletown History Center in Margaretville. And then also tomorrow, join the Radio Catskill team for Pines for Public Radio. We've done a few of these, you know, Pines for Public Radio. They're always so much fun. It's an opportunity for our listeners and our team to come together to drink beer, support public radio. It is that simple. That'll be at the Common Good in Ellenville, New York, tomorrow, May 17th from 2 to 4 p.m. I'm sure it's going to be a great time. More events on our community calendar on our website at wjffradio.org. And that's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's CatsCast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Hey, theater fans, Tom Candela here. On the next episode of Curtain Call, I welcome back Franklin Trapp, the producing artistic director of the Forestburg Playhouse, as we celebrate the Playhouse's landmark 80th anniversary season. We'll take an in-depth look at the evolving role of summer theater and discuss Forestburg's lasting impact on the regional theater community. That's Curtain Call, spotlighting the magic of theater one conversation at a time, Monday night at 7 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.